Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Eagle 16, Massacre of Eagles. By William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by David Coyne, Christopher Sheeran, Gregory Gordon, Michael John Casey, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, James Keegan, Joe Brack, Tim Getman, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, James Lewis, Tony Nam, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Colleen Delaney, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nick DePinto, Dylan Lynch, Nanette Savard, Alyssa Wilmoth, Johan Detweiler, Yasmin Toison, Ren Casey, and Julianne Elliott.
Mean to His Horses was a member of the Crooked Lance Warrior Society and a nephew of the most notable of all Cheyenne warriors, Roman Nose. He was a resident of the Tongue Reservation in the Montana Territory. Mean to His Horses was but a youth when he saw his uncle killed at Beecher Island in September of 1868. Later, Mean to His Horses had been by the side of Crazy Horse in the fight against Custer. Crazy Horse was killed September 5th, 1877, at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. He had been told that he was going to a meeting with the white officials to correct a misunderstanding. The misunderstanding was the result of a deliberate misrepresentation of his words by a translator during an earlier conference. Instead, Crazy Horse was arrested, and as they attempted to put him in a guardhouse, he resisted. During the altercation, Crazy Horse was stabbed and killed. Mean to His Horses thought about this as he was about to enter the sweat lodge. He observed the etiquette that would have been required had there been others in the lodge. He smudged his face with sage. He loaded his sacred pipe with tobacco. He turned in a clockwise circle at the door. Then he moved the hide flap and crawled in through the opening.
All my relations.
Crawling in a clockwise direction, he completely circumnavigated the teepee. Then he poured water over the seven hot stones to produce the steam. He didn't know how long he had been in the sweat lodge when it began. Now, he had built that sweat lodge far from the village, so he knew there were neither drums nor singing to hear. He could see in the clouds of steam a great battle between Cheyenne and white soldiers, and he saw that the Cheyenne were winning because all the soldiers were falling from their horses. The vision faded. The lodge grew so quiet, Mean to Horses could hear his own blood flowing through his veins. A new vision formed. A man with long, curly hair, not too tall, and with a somewhat rounded face. His hair hung to his waist, braided with beaver pelt covering, and with two eagle feathers hanging down on the left. This could be only one person, and yet Mean to His Horses knew this could not be.
Are you Crazy Horse?
Look!
The apparition put his finger to his left jaw.
What do you see here?
Mean to His Horses saw a scar on the left jaw near his mouth and nose. The scar, he knew, remained from a bullet wound where No Water shot Crazy Horse for being with Black Buffalo Woman, No Water's wife at the time.
It is you.
Listen, and I will tell you of a new thing.
Mean to His Horses learned of a new thing. Wajiwanaji, or spirit talking.
If all Indian people will do spirit talking, the great spirit who guides our lives will be pleased, and he will send the whites away so that all the land and the water and the game will return to the Indian people. Mean to his horses, you have been chosen to teach this thing to all Indian people.
And if the white man objects and there is a war?
You are a war leader. If there is to be war, the people will follow you.
I will lead them.
From this day forward, you must wear the sacred paint. The right side of your face, you will paint red. That's for the blood of the whites that must be spilled. The left side of your face, you will paint white. That is so that our people will no longer be in darkness. Do these things, and you cannot fail.
Mean to his horses obeyed the commands of Crazy Horse. He painted the right side of his face red and the left side of his face white. No one asked why he had done this. It was late morning, and Len Kennedy and his two oldest boys, Len Jr. and Luther, were working in the field of the Broken Bar K Ranch near Virginia City when Len's wife Mary called her family in to lunch. They saw 10 Indians approaching and thought nothing of it. All the neighboring Indians were friendly. They rode right up to the back of the house. The Indians, while hunting, often came by the house for water and sometimes for food. Just as often, they left some of their game with Len. He recognized the leader of the group.
Mean to his horses? Why'd you have your face all painted up like that?
An arrow pierced the father's torso. The Indian shot Len Jr. and put arrows in Luther as he tried to climb over the fence. Mary Kennedy ran out onto the back porch.
Mean to his horses! What are you doing?
They grabbed Mrs. Kennedy and the three youngest children. Then five of his warriors went inside and ransacked the house, taking the money box and whatever they thought might be useful.
Oh, why are you doing this? Oh my God! Stop this! Stop, oh God!
The warriors exited the house. Mean to his horses looked at the mother and her children. He nodded. They shot Mary five times. The leader threw a lance through the youngest child's neck. They left 7-year-old Tamara and her 5-year-old brother Donnie to watch over their dead mother, father, and brothers. The next morning, 3 passing freight wagons stopped by the Kennedy spread.
Whoa, Len! Len, where are you? I know you seen us coming, you thick-headed Irishman. How come you ain't out here to meet us where you always are? I got that tobacco you wanted. Len! Len, where are you? It's Doodle Perday.
Doodle shotgun guard, Arthur, shifted in the seat next to him.
Doodle, there's something don't feel right here.
Yeah, it does seem awful quiet, don't it?
Len! Len, where the hell are you?
Doodle! Look over there, on the fence.
Doodle saw Luther's arrow-riddled body draped across the top rung.
Damn, ain't that Len over there?
What the hell happened here?
Doodle climbed down. By now, the other two drivers had seen the bodies as well. Not only Luther and Len, but Len Jr. All three, in addition to bullet wounds, had several arrows protruding from their bodies.
Oh, sweet Jesus, Doodle, look over there!
Arthur pointed to the bodies of Mary and Toby.
God in heaven! Have the Indians gone mad?
After determining that none of the ones they found outside were alive, drivers and shotgun guards went into the house.
Is anyone alive here? Hello? Is anyone here?
Me and Donnie are here.
A voice came from behind a hutch.
Tamara? Tamara, child, come out here.
Tamara and her younger brother crawled out from behind the hutch.
We were hiding in case the Indians came back.
Oh, child, of course you were. That was the wise thing to do.
Are they all dead?
Doodle was amazed at how calm the young girl was. He was sure it was the result of her being totally overcome by the events.
I'm afraid they are, darling.
I thought they were.
I expect you'd better come with us, child.
Not until Mama and Daddy and my brothers are buried.
Overnight, Tamara had aged from a 7-year-old girl to a determined young woman.
The New York Register Journal. Indian depredations, ghastly raids against innocent families, spirit talking the cause. Chicago. Recent savage attacks by Plains Indians have given General Nelson Miles, commanding general of the Department of the Missouri, cause to be concerned about a possible new Indian war. To this end, he has ordered all commanders in the field to be alert for any further savageries. His concern is animated by intelligence from the West, which suggests that the recent horrors perpetrated by various nations of the Sioux, the same tribe of heathens who so foully massacred Custer and all his brave men, may be the harbinger of renewed war against the white race. The cause of the unrest is thought to be something called spirit talking, a quasi-religion espoused by various shamans in which they are told that if all tenets of the strange heresy are followed, the white man will leave the cities and settlements of the West and the land will be returned to the Indians. The Indian who started this movement and is its most vocal spokesman is Mean to His Horses, a leader of the Crooked Lance Warrior Society of the Cheyenne. Mean to His Horses was a relative of Roman Nose, the ferocious Cheyenne warrior who led more attacks against the white man than any other Indian. He was also a follower and protege of Crazy Horse. It is said that the Indians believe that Mean to His Horses is able to communicate with Crazy Horse through the means of spirit talking, and that has given him much
Buffalo
medicine.
Bill's Wild West Exhibition playing to packed house. The Buffalo Bill Wild West Exhibition is performed before the crowned heads of Europe, delighting the royals and their subjects with a view of life in America's Great West. Now that same show is in New York, and should a citizen of this fair city wish to be enlightened about the true nature of the Wild West, they need only to apply at the ticket office at Madison Square Garden, where daily performances are being given.
By the use of clever stage props, dirt, horses, cattle, and cowboys and Indians, Madison Square Garden had been transformed into a part of the American West. Falcon McAllister and his brother and sister, the twins Andrew and Rosanna, were among the many spectators enjoying the Buffalo Bill Wild West Exhibition. So far, the show had portrayed Pony Express mail carriers galloping to deliver the mail, leaping off one horse and instantly mounting another to continue at breakneck speed around the arena. Indians setting fire to and attacking a burning cabin from which heroic settlers would escape just in the nick of time. And stagecoach robbers who were fought off by the bravery of the shotgun guard and armed passengers. They also had cowboys bringing a cattle stampede under control. And it was during the stampede that something went wrong. A bull broke out of the thundering herd to come rushing toward the audience.
Oh, isn't it wonderful how they have trained the bull to do that?
Looking around, Falcon McAllister saw that there was no cowboy in position to be able to stop the runaway. And the reaction of the nearest cowboys to the bull clearly indicated that this was unplanned. There was a mounted New York policeman nearby, but he was for crowd control only. Falcon could tell by the expression on his face that he also thought the runaway bull was part of the show.
Rosanna, I think that bull's gone off script.
With no time to spare, Falcon got up from his seat, climbed onto the railing, and pushing the policeman out of the saddle, he leaped onto the horse. He wished he was on lightning, but he had no choice. This police horse was all he had. He raced across the arena toward the bull.
Stop him! Stop him!
Crowd, still believing that it was all part of the show, cheered in approval and applauded as Falcon bent low over the horse's neck, urged that animal into what was, without a doubt, the fastest it had ever run. As he drew alongside the bull, he could smell its pungent odor and see the fear, confusion, and anger in the bull's eyes. Falcon leaned over the bull, then leaped from the saddle, grabbing the bull by the horns as he did so. He dug his heels into the ground as he twisted the bull's neck, throwing the animal over onto its side. With the bull safely on the ground, Falcon quickly regained his feet, then swung back into the saddle of the horse that had stopped running and was now waiting for him. The bull, its initial charge stopped, got back to its feet, shook its head, and snorted a few times. A couple of the cowboys from the show had come over and herded the bull, docile now, back to rejoin the others. Buffalo Bill himself rode up to Falcon's side, and reaching over, he grabbed Falcon's hand and lifted it up into the air.
Ladies and gentlemen, the cowboy who performed this thrilling rescue for your viewing pleasure is none other than Falcon McAllister!
You're acting as if you'd planned that.
Why not? It was a great act.
I swear, Falcon, that was some exhibition. I may have to put your bid into the show tomorrow. The crowd. The waiters at Delmonico's restaurant on number 2 William Street vied for the opportunity to serve the handsome assemblage of guests in the private dining room on the upper floor. All the diners there were well-known personalities. Buffalo Bill Cody sat to dinner, easily recognizable by his flowing blonde hair with his neatly trimmed mustache and goatee. The McAllister twins, Andrew and Rosanna, the famous show business personalities, sat across the table. Andrew had what the newspapers called rugged good looks, handsome enough to play the most romantic lead, but manly enough to play the most gallant hero. Of Rosanna, it was said that she had discovered the fountain of youth, for her skin was smooth and flawless, her dark hair luxuriant, and her eyes ablaze with still youthful beauty. The fourth diner was Falcon McAllister, brother to the show business twins. Falcon stood over 6 feet tall with wide shoulders, a flat stomach, and powerful arms. Someone once described his face as not weathered, but cured. It bore a permanent tan, and his eyes had the suggestion of a squint, as if he were outside in the sun. Unlike Buffalo Bill, Falcon wore his hair, which was the color of sun-ripened wheat, cut short. The four dined at Delmonico's because after the performance, Buffalo Bill insisted they join him as his guests. An empty chair stood to Cody's right. When Rosanna asked who it was for, Cody was rather circumspect. About 15 minutes later, the mysterious guest arrived. Cody's guest was shorter than any of the other three men present, slender of build with dark, piercing eyes and a sweeping mustache, but no beard.
Friends, may I present Colonel Prentice Ingram. At least, that is the name he's going by today. He's been called, at various times in his life, Dr. Noel Dunbar, Dangerfield Burr, and Colonel Leon Lafitte. Of course, you can understand that when you realize what an unsavory life he's lived. While training for the noble profession of medicine, Ingram left school to become a soldier for the South. He was wounded and captured at Fort Hudson, but escaped, only to be wounded for a second time at the Battle of Franklin, Tennessee. Then, after the war ended, Ingram, not contented to return to civilized life, traveled the world to find another war to fight. He served under Juarez in the Mexican rebels' revolution against Maximilian. Then, he went to Europe to fight against the Turks, was in the Austrian army during the Austro-Prussian War, and was in Egypt with the Khedive's army, and then was a colonel in the Cuban army. And if that isn't enough, he was also a captain in the Cuban Navy. While fighting for the Cubans against Spain, he was captured and sentenced to death, but as they say, only the good die young. So once again, he escaped.
Oh, thank you, Cody. Never have I received a more eloquently delivered introduction.
Sit!
Surely none of that can be true. Have you really lived such a dangerous life?
I have had a terrible case of wanderlust my entire life. But I'm afraid my friend, Bill Cody, is making it sound much more romantic than it really is.
Romantic? Not a word of it. Seedy you are, and seedy I report. And why, my friends, you may ask, would I be friends with such a seedy character?
Are you really going to tell them, Cody? I think they could accept a rebel, a soldier of fortune, and an escaped convict. But if you tell them the worst of my sins, they will rise as one and walk away from here.
Surely, it can't be that bad. What sin is it?
Will you tell them, Ingram, or shall I? Ingram held his hand out toward Cody.
I defer to my esteemed and famous friend, Buffalo Bill Cody.
I am famous because this gentleman made me famous. Indeed, it was he who coined the moniker Buffalo Bill. And he made you famous as well, Falcon, my friend, because to date, he has written over 300 literary masterpieces. At least that's how he refers to them, though the rest of the world considers them dime novels.
Wait a minute. You mean I have you to thank for those awful dime novels about me?
Oh, now you may call them awful, Mr. McAllister, but the rest of the world calls them heroic. With the reins of his horse held tightly in his teeth, a flaming six-gun in each hand dispensing death to the desperados, our hero hurled a challenge that brought fear to the heart of the evildoer. Dangerous Dan, your day is done. I particularly like the alliteration of the letter D. Do you recognize that passage?
Do I recognize it? No, should I?
Well, no, I suppose not. I seriously doubt that anyone with your sterling qualities would ever be impressed by or even read stories that glorify your name. But what I just quoted came directly from that stirring novel of derring-do, Falcon McAllister and the Robbers of the Deadwood Stage.
Andrew looked at his brother, then at the colonel.
If he had the reins of his horse clenched between his teeth, how could he yell?
Ingram stopped to think about it for a moment.
An excellent point, my good man. A most excellent point indeed.
You were at the Wild West exhibition today, Ingram. What did you think of the thrilling new act that I added, hmm? Did you see the way Falcon, who for all intents and purposes was not but a spectator, suddenly appeared from the crowd to wrestle to the ground a runaway bull?
You may have had it planned, Cody, but something tells me that Falcon was not in on the plan.
Maybe not, but knowing Falcon as well as I do, I knew that were I but to present him with an opportunity to be heroic, he would react exactly as he did.
Surely you aren't saying that you arranged for the bull to break away, are you?
That, my dear, will forever be a closely guarded secret. But what about it, Falcon? Would you care to join my exhibition?
Thank you, Cody, but I'll pass. Andrew and Rosanna are the two show business luminaries in the McAllister family.
And luminaries they are. Cody glanced over toward Falcon's siblings. I loved your performance in The Lady and the Soldier.
Thank you.
No, not you, Andrew. I was talking to Rosanna.
Cody, what's the latest on your town?
Your town? What town?
Oh, haven't you heard? There's to be a town in Wyoming territory named Buffalo Bill.
Really? My, how wonderful!
It isn't to be called Buffalo Bill. It is to be called Cody, if it comes about.
It will happen. Thornton Beck is behind it, and he is a man who accomplishes what he starts.
Thornton Beck, the financier in Wyoming Territory.
Yes. He has already developed three towns in Wyoming Territory, Sheridan, Buffalo, and Becton. He wants to develop a town in the Bighorn Basin along the Stinking Water River between Heart Mountain and Cedar Mountain, very near Yellowstone. Do you know the area there?
Yes, I know the area quite well.
I suppose some people might think it a bit vain of me to be interested in a town that bears my name. But I'm sure that you understand the attraction, as you have a town named after you.
Actually, McAllister's named after my father, not me.
Just then, a young man stepped into the room, wearing a cap with a shield stating that he was an employee of Western Union.
Mr. Cody?
Yes, I'm Bill Cody. The young man smiled.
I know you, Buffalo Bill. I would recognize you anywhere. I've seen your Wild West show.
It is an exhibition, my good man. It is not a show. A show is make-believe, whereas an exhibition is real.
Yes, sir, Will. It's real, all right. Oh, I have a telegram for you.
Cody took the telegram and tipped the young man a silver dollar.
Gee, thanks, Buffalo Bill.
Cody opened the telegram and took a moment to read it.
It's from General Miles. He wants me to come to Chicago.
Why?
Here, you read it. You may read it aloud if you wish.
There is a movement among the Indians that they call spirit talking. This is a dangerous new development, and should it get out of hand, I'm concerned that another Indian war might be in the offing. It is also my belief that Sitting Bull is behind the unrest. What the hell? As you are familiar with the Badlands and have befriended Sitting Bull, request you visit me soonest at my headquarters in Chicago. Respectfully, Nelson Miles, General Commanding Department of the Missouri.
My, that certainly sounds like an invitation to adventure.
Falcon handed the telegram back to Cody.
Are you going to see him?
I don't know. He said he wants to see me as soon as possible, but I have one more week of the show remaining in New York. What do you think, Falcon? Have you ever heard of this spirit-talking movement the General mentions?
I have heard of it, yes.
Do you think, as General Miles does, that there might be an Indian uprising because of it?
A general uprising? No, I don't think so. There are some renegades causing problems, but nothing on the order of a full-scale Indian war.
Yes, I think you're right. And even if it were true, Sitting Bull wouldn't have anything to do with it. As you well know, Sitting Bull was, for a short time, a member of my Wild West exhibition. I got to know him very well, and I have a great deal of respect and admiration for him. He told me that it came to him in a spirit dream that the Indians and the white men must live in peace, and that it is the responsibility of the Indians to adapt to our ways.
Do you believe that?
Now, the real question is, does he believe that? And because it came to him in a spirit dream, I think, yes, he does believe it. From what I know of Sitting Bull, he gives great credence to the powers of visions and dreams.
Yeah, and it may well be that is exactly what has Miles worried. As you say, Sitting Bull is known to be a person who believes in talking with spirits, and as this new movement is called spirit talking, it is easy to see how General Miles may have made the connection.
But it's not the same thing.
No, it is not the same thing. However, once something like this gets started, it tends to develop a life of its own. So it's important to get it stopped before it gets started. I know you haven't asked for my opinion, but I think you should suspend the show for now and go see General Miles just as quickly as you can pack your clothes and catch the next train.
All right. I'll do that if you will come with me. General Miles holds you in very high regard. I know he would like to see you, and I would like you with me when I meet him.
I'll come with you. I was about to start back anyway, and it has been a while since I've seen General Miles, so it would be nice to see him again.
So you are saying there's absolutely no possibility that there will be any Indian trouble?
I wouldn't say absolutely. There'll still be a few Indians who, for some excitement or some perceived injustice, are willing to go off the reservation and cause trouble.
I hope so.
You hope so? What a strange thing for you to say.
Rosanna and the others looked at Ingram with equal surprise.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I certainly would not want another incident like what happened to Custer. But a little excitement would be welcome. And as you know, I live for excitement.
It was just after sunup at a Crow village on the Meteetse River in Wyoming Territory when Running Elk left his teepee to walk out onto an overlook where he could view the mountains around him. Though it was late spring, the higher peaks stood covered with snow. Interspersed with the snow-covered peaks, slab-sided cliffs rose 1,000 feet or more into the sky. At the lower ranges lay the sage-covered mountains unfolding in ridges and rolls, marked here and there by patches of light and shadow from the early morning sun. On the lowest elevations of the treeless mountains, watchful elk grazed. Down in the valley, Running Elk could see the river sparkling silver in the sun. Alongside the river grazed a small herd of antelope, and sneaking up on them, a wolf hunted his morning meal. Today, gray antelope and howling wolf were going hunting. Running Elk would have gone with them had they asked, but they did not. He had not been hunting since returning from the white man's school, and he missed it. But he knew it was not his place to invite himself. When Running Elk went east to attend the Carlisle Indian School, the school staff changed his name from Running Elk to Steve Barr. They labeled the Indian ways bad. They told him he must get civilized. He must behave like the white man. While at school, he wore white man's clothes, cut his hair as a white man, ate white man's food, went to the white man's church, and spoke only the language of the white man. Any students overheard speaking their native tongue earned harsh punishment. The books Running Elk learned to read told of the Indian atrocities against the white race. They made no distinction among the Indians as to what tribes extended the hand of friendship to the white man and what tribes warred against the encroaching whites. Running Elk was born Absarika. The Absarika, called Crow by the white man, settled mainly in Montana, though many lived in the Bighorn Basin just outside the newly designated Yellowstone National Park. A Siouan language tribe, the Crow maintained an identity beyond that of the Hunkpapa, Lakota, Oglala, Minneconjou, Brule, Blackfoot, and Cheyenne, their traditional enemies. Due to this natural enmity, the Crow allied with the U.S. Army during their fight with the Sioux. When Running Elk first returned to his tribal home after a four-year absence, many in the tribe treated him as a stranger. They could not abide the ways and habits he acquired while he was away. It took a while for the rest of the tribe to accept him. But Quiet Stream, well, she greeted him warmly from the first day he was back.
Quiet Stream.
Quiet Stream was a young woman who caught Running Elk's eyes even before he left for school. Now he was thinking about marrying her. But in order to do so, he would have to present gifts to satisfy her father, Stone Eagle, and convince him he was worthy of his daughter.
Could it be that the others are right, and you have lost your Indian ways? Had you not gone to the white man's school, I would not have been able to sneak up on you.
Turning toward the sound of the voice, Running Elk saw Quiet Stream smiling at the trick she had just played on him.
You did not sneak up on me. I heard you.
Oh? And has the white man also taught you to lie?
You are right. I did not hear you. But that is because you crossed the ground like a butterfly.
Aha! Another lie you learned from the white man. But this lie, I like.
Running Elk saw Gray Antelope and Howling Wolf mount their horses as they left for their hunting trip. Quiet Stream read in his eyes his disappointment at not having been invited to go with them.
You should have gone with them.
No.
Do you not wish to hunt with Running Elk and Gray Antelope? I think you do. I think I see this in your face.
They did not ask me.
Perhaps they did not know you wished to go. You should have asked them.
One should be invited. One should not ask.
Have you not asked my father for me? Or has only White Bull asked?
White Bull has asked.
Last night he came to our teepee and asked my father if he could marry me.
What did Big Hand say?
He said another has asked, and that he must think on this.
What do you say?
It is you I prefer. And I will say this to my father. Do not worry. He will listen to me.
White Bull and Running Elk were friends, and had been friends since both were young. But Running Elk had gone to the white man's school, and White Bull had not. It wasn't a matter of Running Elk choosing to go. In fact, he had no choice in the matter at all. He had been chosen by the Indian agent and told that he would go. With his return, Running Elk found the relationship between him and his old friend changed. They bore no animosity between them, but neither did they share the closeness of the past. Now, with both young men interested in the same woman, the situation could only worsen. When Falcon and Cody stepped down from the train in Chicago, they were met by a young army lieutenant accompanied by two enlisted men. Stepping up to Cody, the lieutenant saluted.
Colonel Cody, I'm Lieutenant Vaughn. If you will come with me, sir, I have a carriage waiting that will take you to your meeting with General Miles.
Thank you, Lieutenant. That is most kind of you. This is Falcon McAllister. I've brought him with me to meet with the General.
Sir, I don't mean to be particular, but General Miles said nothing about anyone named Mr. McAllister. I was told to meet you and provide you with transportation to the General's headquarters.
I assume, Lieutenant, that the carriage you have brought is large enough to accommodate all of us?
Yes, sir.
Then I suggest that you let me handle the General. General Miles stood when Lieutenant Vaughn brought the two men into his office. A tall, slender man, General Miles looked very much at ease in the uniform of an Army general, though unlike most of the other generals in the Army, Miles was not a graduate of West Point. In fact, he had been a clerk in a crockery factory when the Civil War began, and he volunteered his services as a private. He was commissioned a second lieutenant shortly after he enlisted, and he rose quickly through the ranks, attaining the brevet rank of Major General at the very young age of 26. After the war, he was appointed colonel and given command of the 5th Cavalry. It was there that he met Buffalo Bill Cody, though then Cody was not known as Buffalo Bill and there was no Wild West exhibition. Then it was simply William Cody, Army Scout. Now Cody was a world-famous show business personality, and Nelson Miles was commandant of the Department of the Missouri, again wearing the rank and uniform of a major general.
Colonel Cody, it was good of you to come. Please, come over to the nest and have a seat.
The nest General Miles referred to was a collection of sofas and chairs in the corner of his commodious office. It was here that he held meetings with his subordinates when he wanted them to feel comfortable. He was well known among his officers as a no-nonsense general who never invited anyone to the nest on routine matters, nor did he if they had done something to evoke his displeasure.
General, I hope you don't mind, but as you can see, I have brought someone with me.
Falcon McAllister.
General Miles extended his hand for a hearty handshake.
Didn't expect to see you here. It's been a long time.
That it has, General. I hope you don't mind that I came with Cody.
Mind? No, of course I don't mind. But tell me, are you a member of the Buffalo Bill Wild West Exhibition now?
Well, he sure is. You should have seen him the other day. He raced after a runaway bull and leaped from the saddle to grab the critter by the horns and bring him down. And I might add, he did this just in the nick of time, because the creature was hell-bent to dash into the audience to work its mayhem.
Isn't that a dangerous act to be putting into your show? Or is that just part of your spiel?
It's true, all right. But believe me, it wasn't part of the act. The bull just got away.
Buffalo Bill Cody, P.T. Barnum has nothing on you. Falcon, our friend here is without doubt the greatest self-promoter on Earth.
Tell me, General, what is the emergency? Why did you send for me?
I'm sure you've heard of the recent disturbances coming from some of our western territories. There was an incident where a farmer named Kennedy and his wife were killed, along with two of his children. They were massacred by Indians. A stagecoach was also attacked, and two whites were killed. There have been some prospectors killed, and a freight wagon train was attacked.
I have heard of some of it, yes. The newspapers have carried the reports, though I am always of the belief that the newspapers tend to exaggerate the events to make a better story.
Oh, believe me, there's no exaggeration. These events have occurred. And now we've been getting some disturbing reports from some of the more friendly Indians suggesting that these may not be isolated events, that there may be something afoot among the Sioux. We are also hearing that Sitting Bull himself may be behind it. I know he was with your show for a while.
Yes, he was, but he was only with us for about 4 months. I paid him $50 a week to ride around the ring one time. He was quite a box office attraction. He wound up making even more money selling his autograph.
Is it true that he yelled curses at the audience in Lakota?
Well, since he was the only member of the show who could speak the language, that is something only Sitting Bull knows.
Be that as it may, the task I have for you is a simple one, if you'll agree to take it. I want you to go to Standing Rock to visit Sitting Bull. Well, it isn't Standing Rock anymore, now it's Fort Yates. But most people still call it Standing Rock. Anyway, I want you to speak to him while you're there and determine if you can, if there is another Indian uprising in the making. If there is, I want you to find out if he's a part of it. Though I have no doubt that he'll say he isn't.
I am sure he will say that he isn't a part of it, General, and he will be telling the truth. I do not believe for one moment that he is instigating another Indian uprising.
General, are you talking about Waji Wanaji?
Waji Wanaji?
Spirit talking.
Yes, spirit talking, that's it. I'm told it has all the Indians in a frenzy.
The Indian behind spirit talking is mean to his horses, not Sitting Bull.
Falcon is right, General. I think you're making a mistake. I am certain Sitting Bull has nothing to do with this. General Miles stroked his mustache as he looked at Cody and Falcon.
Have I chosen the wrong man for this job, Colonel Cody? Have you become so enamored of him that you'll believe anything he tells you?
General, if you will allow me, I have a suggestion.
Oh, by all means, Falcon. If you have any ideas, please share them with me. This is too important to let something pass without exploring every avenue.
With your permission, I will accompany Colonel Cody. Although I have no doubt that the Colonel is capable of determining whether or not Sitting Bull will be telling the truth, it is also possible that the two of us will sharpen the perception.
Yes. An excellent idea, Colonel McAllister.
Colonel McAllister?
Bill Cody's already a colonel in the Army Scouts, and for the duration of this assignment, I'm appointing you as well. Both of you will be paid accordingly. Though, Bill, as much money as you make with your Wild West exhibition, I'm afraid any army pay you draw would be an insult.
I will serve for the honor of service, General, not for the money. One can never be insulted by honor.
Well then, gentlemen, as of now, you are both on the payroll of the United States Army. I hereby grant you authority to act upon your own and to use, when necessary, the power of your rank to thoroughly investigate the matter pertaining to Indian unrest and possible uprising. And our Lieutenant Vaughn has made reservations for the two of you at the Palmer Hotel. On the Army's tab, of course.
When they reached the Palmer Hotel, they were surprised to see Prentice Ingram waiting for him in the lobby.
Ingram, what a surprise! What a coincidence seeing you here in the same hotel.
Isn't it, though?
Why do I have a feeling it's not a coincidence?
Perhaps because you are an astute man.
So, it isn't a coincidence?
Oh, not exactly.
Not exactly.
All right, it isn't at all a coincidence.
But then my question is, how did you know we would be staying here at the Palmer Hotel?
Oh, that part was easy. The Palmer is the best hotel in Chicago, and knowing you as I do, I knew that you would stay in no less a place.
Well, you guessed right. But I didn't make the choice. The Army chose the hotel.
So I heard. You see, I have a confession to make. I went to the headquarters of the Department of the Missouri, and there met the young officer who bears the responsibility of looking out for you, Lieutenant Vaughn. I suggested that you would be satisfied with no less an accommodation than the Palmer. He agreed. So you have me to thank for these superb lodgings.
And I do thank you.
The one unanswered question now is, why are you here?
I am here to research my next book.
You're going to write a novel about Chicago?
No, he isn't writing about Chicago. He's writing about you.
Oh, you're too smart for me, Falcon. Except it isn't going to be a novel. I will be writing a non-fiction tome.
Evidently, he is too smart for me as well, because I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
My dear boy, whatever mission General Miles has assigned you will be the subject of my book. I am going with you.
Oh, no, you aren't.
Oh, I'm afraid you can't prevent it.
We'll see about that. I'm going to see General Miles tomorrow.
I'm afraid it won't do you any good.
If General Miles says you can't go with us, you cannot go with us.
Oh, not even General Miles can prevent me from going with you.
What makes you say such a thing?
Cody, I believe Mr. Ingram is holding an ace up his sleeve.
An ace up his sleeve?
In a manner of speaking. What is it, Ingram? What are you not telling us?
On the night I learned that Buffalo Bill was to come here on a mission for General Miles, I sent a telegram to Washington, D.C., where I have some, shall we say, friends in high places. I now have authority to accompany him from no less a dignitary than General Sherman himself, Commanding General of the United States Army.
Do you know that Colonel McAllister is going with me?
No. Really? Why, that is wonderful.
What's so wonderful about it?
Well, think about it, Colonel McAllister. I have written novels about Buffalo Bill, and I have written novels about Falcon McAllister. Now I will be able to write a non-fiction book that will include both of you.
Oh, good God.
Don Kelly and his brother Al were knee-deep in the rapid-running stream of Thoroughfare Creek, located in Bighorn Basin, Wyoming Territory. The water was white foam where it broke over the rocks, but otherwise it was crystal clear, and they could see all the way to the bottom as they dipped their pans into the rocks and sand. Slowly sloshing the water around, they gradually emptied their pans of the water, sand, and lighter gravel. Then, they studied the residue remaining in the bottom of the pan.
Woo-hoo! Don! Don! Get over here! Look at this!
Al turned his pan slightly, and Don could see in the bottom of the pan bright flashes.
That's gold, Don! There's bound to be more here!
Now we're getting somewhere.
Don joined his brother in the part of the river he was working. And with his very first pan, he came up with gold of his own.
If we keep this up, we'll take $75 to $100 out here just today.
As the two men continued to pan the river, they spread out a cloth on the bank and piled their gold there. Some of the gold came in nuggets as large as kernels of corn. Within 2 hours, they had accumulated several ounces. Don examined the pile.
$75 my hind leg. We got $200, maybe $300 here if we have a dime.
The town of Damaris Springs was in the shadows of Cedar Mountain, bordered on the south by Stinking Water River and on the north by the hot springs that gave its town its name. The mountain saloon was made of rip-sawed, wide unpainted boards. Though it did have a false front with the name of the saloon rendered in black outlined in red. It was the center of activity in a little town of under 200 people, and it had the distinction of having one of the only two pianos in the town, the other being in Mademoiselle Mouchette's house for discriminating gentlemen. Excitement ran high in the saloon as Don and Al Kelly shared the news of their gold find.
Oh, there ain't no telling how much gold there is up there.
And where'd you find it?
I ain't gonna tell you that. You're gonna have to go look for yourself to find your own gold.
But it's up there. If we was able to find what we did, why, my guess is that it's all over the valley.
I'm going up there.
Yeah, me too!
Sam Davis and Lee Regret sat in a quiet corner, observing the frenzy. Davis was a man of medium height and size. Clean-shaven, his most distinguishing feature was a pockmarked face and a drooping left eye. The droop was the result of an old wound suffered in a knife fight the first time Davis wound up in jail. Regret was relatively small, and so dark he often got mistaken for a Mexican. He wore a full beard as dark as his long black hair. Davis and Regret didn't crowd around the two brothers trying to get more information. They already had the information they needed. Regret leaned forward in his chair.
Bellefontaine ain't gonna like this. There's too many prospectors up there already. This is just gonna bring a lot more of them.
No, he ain't gonna like it at all.
We're gonna have to tell him.
Not yet.
What do you mean, not yet? He's gonna find out sooner or later. They don't be mad at us for not telling them.
Oh, we're going to tell them. But not until after we've took care of the problem.
Took care of the problem? How are we going to do that?
You'll see.
When Don and Al left the mountain saloon, they were so excited by their discovery that they didn't notice the two men following them. Their only thought was to get back to the creek where they had first made their discovery and start panning again. It took 2 hours of riding before they returned to the spot where they had discovered gold. And within a few moments after they started panning, they were bringing up more color. Sam Davis and Lee Regret watched the two men for a few moments. And they saw with their own eyes the success the Kelly brothers were having.
They wasn't lying, Regret. They really did discover gold. They just got started. And look at the gold they done got piled up alongside them there.
Yeah, I see it.
That sure is something.
What are we gonna do now?
Like I said when we started out, we're gonna take care of the problem.
Gotcha. Let's go.
With pistols in hand, two rode up to the gold pan and brothers.
What are you doing here? What'd you do, follow us? We told you people back in town to find your own place. This is ours.
Not anymore. You know why? Because you got a big mouth. Now, if it'd been me, I'd have kept my mouth shut and kept panning until I got all the gold I could pull out of here. You didn't do that, though, did you? Nope. You just painted a big old bullseye on your back, rode out of town, and brought us with you.
Davis and Regret trained their pistols on the two brothers.
What? No, wait. Now, you don't need no guns. You can have this spot. Me and my brother will find someplace else.
There is no place else for you. This whole valley belongs to Mr. Bellefontaine.
Bellefontaine? He might own the town, but he don't own this valley. This is public land.
No, it ain't public land. This land and everything on it belongs to Mr. Bellefontaine. So what I'm gonna ask you to do is hand over the gold, pack up your belongings, and leave.
Hand over the gold? Are you crazy? Me and my brother been working out here for near a month, and this is the first color we've turned up. So we ain't giving it away. Besides which, there ain't nobody said nothing to us about this being private property. Seeing as you got guns and are making us do it, we'll go somewhere else, but we ain't handing over the gold we done found here.
I'm sorry you feel that way.
Ow! Oh my God, ow!
Don turned to Davis.
You bastard, you killed my brother!
Yeah, I did, didn't I?
Don went down as well. Now both brothers were lying face down in water. Swirls of blood, caught up by the swift current, began flowing downstream. Davis got down from his horse and, drawing his knife, proceeded to scalp both of the prospectors.
Get the gold, Regret!
Regret dismounted, walked over to the bank, folded the cloth over, and scooped up the gold.
We going to tell Bellefontaine about the gold?
We got to.
Davis stuck his hands into the swiftly flowing water to wash away the blood.
Why? How's anyone going to find out?
What would we do with the gold, even if we did keep it? Bellefontaine owns the bank. Soon as we tried to cash it, he'd find out. Then we'd be in a lot of trouble. We got easy jobs that pay good. Hell, why get greedy just over a few dollars in gold?
Pierre Bellefontaine owned Bellefontaine Mineral Asset Development Company, a large mining company operating in the public land area throughout the Bighorn Basin. One of the largest mining operations of its kind, it employed prospectors, geologists, engineers, and miners, men who willingly gave up the uncertainty of merely looking for gold for the certainty of a paycheck by working for someone else who was willing to take the risk. Now, Bellefontaine was willing to take risks because he could afford them. In addition to the Bellefontaine Mineral Asset Development Company, he also owned the Bank of Damaris Springs, the Damaris Springs Mercantile, the Bellefontaine Freight Line, and the stagecoach line that connected Damaris Springs with Sheridan, Wyoming Territory, and Billings, Montana Territory, Billings being the closest railhead. Bellefontaine often made the remark, and with some justification, that he owned the town of Damaris Springs. Located in the Stinking Water Valley, Damaris Springs was the only town between Green River, Wyoming Territory, and Virginia City, Montana Territory, and between Buffalo, Wyoming Territory, and Yellowstone National Park. He also knew what many others did not know. The real gold of the Bighorn Basin wasn't gold at all. It was coal. Gold finds had been few and far between, but his mining engineers had told him that there was a vein of coal that rivaled that of any other coal-producing area in the country. And with steam engines transitioning from wood to coal, this find was going to be worth a fortune. Still, Bellefontaine had two problems. One problem was the number of gold prospectors who continued to work the valley in their quest of the yellow metal. The other was the increasing number of ranchers and farmers moving into and settling the valley. In order for his dream of a coal empire to work, he needed uninhibited access to the entire valley. At the moment, Bellefontaine was dealing with two of his employees, Lee Regret and Sam Davis. They had brought him information about their encounter with the Kelly brothers. Bellefontaine examined the map spread out before him.
And you say they found gold here?
Yes, sir. And they told the other folks about it as well. Like as not, there are 20 or 30 more people out there now than there was yesterday.
Are you sure they found gold? Or were they just talking?
No, sir. They found gold, all right. This gold.
Davis pulled the little cloth-wrapped package from his pocket. He put the package on the desk in front of Bellefontaine. Bellefontaine examined it, moving the small nuggets around with his finger.
How is it that you did not keep this gold for yourselves?
Well, sir, it's like you said. The land, and everything in it, belongs to you. Wouldn't be right for us to be running the other folks out of there by telling them everything out there belongs to you, then us be keeping this gold they found. Most especial since we are working for you.
Wouldn't be right. Or you knew you would be caught.
Maybe both.
Bellefontaine turned again to the map.
How many people do you think are in this area?
Don't nobody know for sure. Could be 100 or more. All of them prospecting.
Other than this little pile of gold, are they finding anything?
Don't nobody know that neither. But if them two that was in the saloon come up with gold, then it would be a safe bet to say that others is gonna do it too. Especially like I said, since they come into the saloon miling off about it. That couldn't have done nothing but start a little gold rush.
I would try and buy all of them out, but if there are 100 in there and they all wanted $1,000, it would about break me. Especially with all the money I've already got in mining equipment. It wouldn't do any good anyway unless every one of them agreed to a buyout. And I don't think they are going to do that, do you?
No, sir. I sure don't.
You said you took care of the two men who panned this gold?
Yes, sir.
Where are they now?
Where are they? They're still lying there as far as I know.
Good. If some of the other prospectors come across them, it may not be a bad thing if they get the idea that it's dangerous out there.
Yes, sir. That's sort of what we was thinking. That's why I scalped them.
You what? You scalped them?
Yes, sir. I figured it would make it look like the engine's done it.
Yes, that's probably a good idea. But I'm afraid that two scalped prospectors won't be enough to get everyone out of there. And getting everyone out of there is what we need to do.
If you're really wanting all them folks out of there, me and Regret have come up with this idea.
What idea is that?
Well, you might mind, Mr. Bellefontaine, that me and Regret was once soldiers. Members of the 6th Cavalry we was, out of Fort Keogh.
Yes, I know that.
Well, sir, we still keep in touch with some of our old pards, and they've been telling us about engines attacking prospectors, ranchers, farmers, and the like up in Montana. And they've been talking about something new that's going on with all the engines now.
Something new? What are you talking about?
It's called spirit talking.
Spirit talking? What's so new about that, Regret? Indians are always talking to spirits.
Not like this. Like Davis said, this here is something new. Seems like a chief by the name of Mean to His Horses has been saying that the spirits is telling him that all the white men are going to leave, and all the land is going to be given back to the Indians.
And they actually believe that?
A whole lot of them do. And like I said, they've been sort of helping it along up there in Montana, attacking citizens and all. And it's got the army all worried. They're looking for an uprising among the Indians.
Mean to His Horses is Crow, is he?
No, sir. He's Cheyenne.
That's all very interesting, but what has that got to do with our problem? All the Indians we have around here are Crow.
Well, that's just the thing, you see? It ain't just the Cheyenne that's been doing the spirit talking. It's spread all over the Sioux Nation. Lakota, Oglala, Brule, Minneconju, Hunk Papa, and even some among the Shoshone and the Crow. So, what if we was sort of give the Indians a little poke, so to speak, and prod them into going onto the warpath? It would wind up running all the squatters off.
What good would that do me? If the Indians run everyone out of the valley, I won't be able to be in there either.
Sure you will. What'll happen is this.
Once engines go on the warpath, the army will come in and move them out. Not only from the public land, more than likely run them off their own reservation as well. Once that happens, it'll leave the whole valley open. At least from here all the way to the Yellowstone.
Do you think you could do that? Get the Indians to attack the prospectors?
Oh yes, I think me and Regret could do that just real easy.
Bill Fontaine stared at Davis for a long moment. Then, a huge smile spread across his face.
My damn! You two boys come up with that idea, did you?
Yes, sir. Me and Regret.
Well, let me tell you, that is one hell of a good idea. How soon can you get started?
On the Northern Pacific Railroad, Angus Ebersole had 7 men with him. In truth, it made his gang a little unwieldy by having so many, but it also made him formidable. There were few posses that were this large, and no target he ever selected would have as many guards as he had men. He was waiting now with his men along the Northern Pacific Railroad in Dakota Territory for the train that would be coming through in about half an hour. The train, he knew, would be carrying the payrolls for Fort Lincoln, Fort Rice, and Fort Harrison. The payrolls for 3 army posts would be a considerable amount, enough money so that even divided 8 ways, it would make this operation a very profitable one.
Dewey, Hawkins, do you have the wood laid out on the track?
Yeah, it's all there. Think we ought to light it yet?
Not yet. We don't want to burn down too much before the train gets here.
Dewey turned to Hank Taylor.
Hey, Taylor, what are you going to do with your money?
I'm going down to Arizona where the weather is warm and the Mexican girls is hot, and I'm going to get me a room, a case of tequila, and have me a different senorita every night.
Well, that sounds good enough for me.
Hush!
Ebersole held his hand up.
I think I hear it.
Yeah, that's it. And we better light the fire?
All right. Go ahead. Get it started.
Augmented by kerosene, the fire took quickly, and it was blazing brightly by the time they saw the train. From this distance, against the great panorama of the surrounding mountains, that train seemed quite small. When they heard the steam valve close and the train began braking, Ebersole knew the engine spotted the fire and was going to stop. The train ground to a reluctant halt, its stacks puffing black smoke, its driver wheel wreathed in tendrils of white steam drifting off into the night. The engineer's face appeared in the window, backlit by the orange glow of the cab.
What's up? What's the fire for? Is there a track out ahead?
Get your hands up.
What? Good God, man! Are you telling me this is a train robbery?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. Taylor, climb up there on the coal tender and keep your eyes on the 2 of them.
Falcon slid his curtains apart just long enough to look out into the aisle of the sleeper car. Falcon saw Cody sticking his head through the curtains of the top bunk just across the aisle from him. And Ingram was looking out from the bottom bunk. You have any idea what's going on?
No, but I don't like it. I think I'll have a look around.
I think I'll join you. Slipping back into the bunk, Falcon pulled on his trousers and boots. Then picking up his gun belt, he stepped out into the aisle as he strapped it on. By now, several others were looking out from the bunks. Women, children, and men of all ages. Cody stepped out into the aisle with Falcon, and like Falcon, he had put on his gun belt. Ingram stepped out as well, though unlike Falcon and Cody, he was unarmed. When Falcon and Cody started toward the front of the car, Ingram went with them.
Where are you going?
With you two.
You stay here. We don't know what's out there.
I know. That's why I'm going with you.
When the 3 men stepped out of the train, they could see the steam drifting away from the engine, so white against the dark night that it was almost luminescent. The only light to be seen was that cast through the windows of the coaches. A few of the windows were open, and heads were poked through, looking toward the front.
You folks best keep your heads inside. We don't know what this is all about yet.
When they got close enough to the front to see what was going on, they saw at least 8 men, 4 mounted and 4 dismounted. One of the dismounted men was on top of the tender, pointing his gun toward the cab of the engine. The other 3 were standing on the ground just outside the express car.
You may as well open the door. We have dynamite. And if you don't open it, we'll blow this car all to hell.
Gentlemen, you have chosen the wrong train to rob. The 2 men with me are none other than Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody.
Ingram, what in God's name are you doing?
I am helping these gentlemen understand that they have made a big mistake.
The 3 men on the ground turned toward Falcon, Cody, and Ingram, lighting the night up with the bright flares of their muzzle flashes. Falcon and Cody returned fire, and all 3 went down.
Damn! Did you see that? Let's get out of here!
Bring me my horse!
The man on the coal tender waved his hat, but the 4 riders who had been holding the horses of the 4 who had dismounted rode away without responding to his call.
You no-count bastards!
The man on the tender pointed his gun at the retreating robbers, but he didn't fire. Instead, realizing that Falcon and Cody were quickly closing on him, he threw his pistol down, then put his hands up.
Well, I give up! I give up! Don't shoot! I ain't making no fight of it!
Climb down!
Meekly, the man did as ordered.
Mr. McAllister, Mr. Cody, the Northern Pacific owes the 2 of you a big thank you for saving the train.
McAllister? Cody? You mean this here fellow wasn't lying? You really are Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody?
They are indeed. You need not feel shame over being bested in your failed endeavor, for you have been taken by the most famous and skilled shootists in the world.
Who are you?
I, sir, am merely a simple purveyor of tales. A scribe who records the heroic deeds of such men as these. I'm sure you've heard of me. I am Prentice Ingram.
Prentice Ingram? No. No, I can't say as I have ever heard of you.
Ingram was visibly crestfallen.